Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones.
So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
Our next guest has been described as part writer, part journalist, part politico, part historian, part economist, and mostly brains, intellect and common sense. He's also been described as the finest radical voice of this generation. I first came across David Boyle last year when I read his wonderfully subversive Tick Box, which explores the insidious philosophy of automaton and the misuse of data that weighs heavily upon us. It's impossible to work in the public sector and read his book and not experience a huge wave of overwhelming familiarity. In fact, those of us who work for the NHS but within a prison are unfortunate enough to experience a double dose of corporate inefficiency. Last year, I'd invited David along to have a conversation at a conference the FENS unit was due to hold to celebrate its 20th year anniversary. But unfortunately, coronavirus put paid to those plans. So I'm absolutely delighted that I've managed to find an opportunity to sit down with you and have that conversation today instead, David. So welcome along.
David wanted us to let you know that due to an illness, his voice was somewhat weaker than it usually is during this podcast. Hello, David. Pleased to meet you. Can you tell us something about your career trajectory? You've had a very rich and vibrant career, which has included writing many books, founding the think tank Radix, and conducting a review of the Treasury and Cabinet Office.
That pretty much sums it up, I think. You've pretty much got it there. Radix, in fact, it's Radix, called Radix. I've always managed to sort of have two parts to my career always. One is sort of hippy-dippy sort of thing. So I started the New Weather Institute, new think tank. The other is sort of more conventional liberal democrat sort of thingy, like Radix.
So what have you done in your life up to now?
I've been a reporter. I trained as a journalist. So most of my books have come out of that in some way or other.
I think that really shows from the style of Tick Box, actually. It's really rich with facts pulled together from quite diverse areas of life, but all illustrating that same theme.
More recently, I've become interested in history, so I've been writing history books. So the sort of way in which these sort of things come together.
So when you describe yourself as being an earlier times a journalist and also having conducted a review of the Treasury and Cabinet Office, that sounds horribly resonant of today's Conservative government with Cummings and Johnson. Presumably you see yourself as being a bit different from that.
Well, I did. It was very odd to get the appointment to be asked to. So the only person who's ever done a review for the Treasury on paid for out of tax credits. A large review, a large advance I got for a book about writing about the middle classes. But, so it was very interesting, but very unnerving, because I'd never been anything like that before.
It must have been, yes. So how did you come to write a book on the phenomenon of Tick Box?
20 years ago I wrote a book called The Tyranny of Numbers, which is sort of the beginning of which is one of my most successful books, actually. I remember a friend of mine afterwards, So at the time that I ended the book with this quotation from a Scottish proverb which says, "Don't make sheep any fatter by weighing them." He used this phrase when he was running a big charity which got a big grant from the Home Office, and he used this phrase to his grant officer discussing the following years. Money. He said afterwards that you'd see the look of rage going over the man's face. So he wished he hadn't done it. But
That is a great phrase. I really loved reading that in the Tick Box, actually. It reminds me of in the 90s, I think, became aware of this kind of culture of Tick Box beginning to invade us when I was working part-time for the Oxford University Counselling Service, and I began to realise that what I did, the kind of job that I had, was beginning to be broken down into dozens and dozens of different activities. And at some point I was going to be expected to kind of meet every one of these differently described activities. And so I decided to get out of that field as quickly as possible. Does that sound familiar to you?
I think that what happened was that increasingly people wanted to turn it into, well, the powers that be wanted to turn every professional fact, every professional sort of skill into something that could be deliverable by software. Partly also they wanted to see how you were doing it. It's a way of increasing trust and transparency. Unfortunately, the more they increased the trust and transparency, the less trust and transparency there was, for some reason.
It seems kind of quite paradoxical. It almost seems like tick box was popular because people wanted to drive up quality, but actually it seems to have reduced quality in many areas.
It's quite true. I wrote a book some years ago called The Human Element, which tried to sort of identify that element, which one couldn't quite define. So after all, you know, you've got all these people out there who bring up children, use huge skills to bring up children every day, to get through life in that way, but they're not considered to be successful or professional or anything like that. So they don't get measured on it. But it's a good thing they don't be, but equally shows how deep the skills are in this country.
So why do you think tick boxes are so popular with big organisations? It seems as though the bigger the organisation, the more inclined they are to use them.
You've hit the nail on the head. I think that's the key question, really. It's the key question we need to answer. I'm not quite sure what the answer is, but I think it's to do with people being wanted to see from the front line. They can't really understand what's going on. They're at the top of the organisation. They need to believe these figures. That's what they're there for, they do. It sort of cascades through the organisation in that way. Through the front line knows they're fake, knows they don't tell them anything. But at the top, they don't know that. What can they do? They're so divorced from the front line, they have to sort of hold on to it.
That's interesting. And do you think there's a kind of like a lack of trust in the frontline staff? Is it partly about trying to feel like they've got a handle on what the frontline workers are doing?
Definitely not. Trust them at all. I think, oddly enough, you know, the more transparency and trust one gives in these figures, the less there is. It's a very peculiar paradox. I'm not sure why that should be either. It's one of those peculiar things.
Many years ago, there was a film called, I think it was called I'm All Right, Jack, which had somebody called Ian Carmichael, a time and motion man, clashing with the trade unions. It was a kind of comedy. So obviously that was an attempt to measure what the workers did, as it were. How does the tick box exercise culture compare to that, or is it just a reincarnation?
I think it's a reincarnation of it, really. It's also a reincarnation of it that in some ways has defeated bureaucracy. That's the idea of it. I think you want to get rid of the bureaucrats, so you have this instead. It's all automated, so nobody really notices it. And yet somehow it's just as insidious as huge amounts of bureaucracy, more so because there's no human being at the end of it. So yeah, I think you're quite right.
That's an interesting idea, to get rid of bureaucracy, because I suppose a bit of me have been thinking, well, this is just bureaucracy gone mad.
I think it's the reverse of bureaucracy in some ways. I think that's why they've brought it in, because that's the sort of idea that somehow the Americans, internet gurus, have somehow got rid of, swept all the bureaucracy away. You can't afford those people anymore, so we just replace it with software.
Yeah, that's shocking, really. I mean, it kind of links up with the whole idea that what matters most is not so much people's lives, but profit. Would you say?
Well, I think that's the trouble, that in the end what gets measured is what, not just what can be measured, it's what the people at the top think is most important. If they think the profit is important, then that's what will get measured. They don't really see the whole thing in any way. It's bound to be polarised that way, I think.
And yet, kind of like the public sector, where profit is obviously less of an issue, it seems to be particularly pervasive, doesn't it, during the public
costs.
Sector? Yeah.
Costs.
Public sector.
Yeah. Because I think under Blair and Brown, they really believed in the one best way. You know, the one best way? The phrase from the... Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name now, but... So I think that there was only one way of doing it, so they broke down, made sure you do it that way. It's a crazy sort of side effect of that.
I suppose the word in the public sector was efficiency rather than profit, but perhaps they're rather similar.
No, really. Efficiency for what? For money or for light or for what? That's the question.
So, David... Sorry, Naomi.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask David, how does tick box impact on real people's lives?
Well, I think that the danger is that if you get the wrong side of it, then you're really stuck, aren't you? Like those people did with the Home Office, or like the, for instance, those people from the Post Office recently, sub-postmasters, those people who've been completely slaughtered by it, sent to prison and everything.
I know it's...
So it can be very dangerous. I think, you know, you want to see the situation whereby, how can you have a situation whereby people leave their consciences at the door when they operate the software? And I think that's what happened in those cases.
I know, I think you give a very real example in your book about how with the Windrush scandal, because of the layers of tick box, that the people are actually handling the conversations with real life people, and not the people that end up making the decisions, and those layers of removal make it possible to then make really quite harsh decisions that impact on people in quite a cruel way. And I think you're right in terms of highlighting what happened with those postmasters, and nothing can give, you know, it wouldn't matter how much compensation you gave those people, you've actually destroyed their lives, their reputations. You know, how do you give people the time back of all of those years? So there's a huge cost, isn't there, on people's lives of this tick box mentality? And I heard tick box referred to last week when they were discussing the bomb at the Manchester Evening News Arena, and talking about how that had its origins in tick box training. You know, where the training was, rather than thinking about real quality and what training actually means, just making people jump through hoops that where a tick box would then be ticked.
Yes. I mean, when I was writing The Tyranny of Numbers, I came to this conclusion about the emperor's new clothes. In any situation, you need to be able to say, can you say about, okay, the school is fine, but is the education okay? School's good and up high on the league tables, but if you've put out that but, you've asked the emperor's new clothes question of the little boy in the Hans Christian Andersen story. And when you do that, it all falls to dust.
You've reminded me this morning about the post office staff, some of whom went to prison, and as we talk, I realise I'm being filled with a sort of sense of outrage, really, because these, along with the case of Anthony Bryan and others, were an immense scandal. They were actually human rights abuses, and I'm not sure we're making enough of them as we should.
I agree, and they're definitely a problem with tick box, aren't they? But I mean, I think that most people don't get affected in that way. I think they're just affected to a lot of tick boxing. If they're not working for the public sector or something like that, they're asked, they go to the bank to reevaluate what their last bank meeting with a bank clerk was like.
So how does tick box affect those staff that have to comply with the tick box culture and follow those particular algorithms?
Well, I think it makes them less human myself, turns them into machines a little bit, a tiny little bit. I'm sure they're fine at home and everything like that, but at work, they leave their consciousness and everything else outside the door. So, that's the problem. Main problem, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think that if you're being met with, you know, if you think about the Windrush situation, for instance, it must have been met with people who were really quite desperately imploring their situation. And how do you manage those face-to-face interactions and frustrations? And you probably feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall trying to get your manager to see something different. So I guess if that's your job and you're having to do that day in, day out, it seems like it would only be possible to do that by disconnecting from your own humanity in some way, as you say. And
because nobody sees the whole case, so they just see a little bit. And that morning they give a little bit of it, they just move it along. We need this bit of information now, we haven't got it. And somebody else deals with it the next day. If it's nothing to do with you, really, you don't have to worry about it, the whole thing. It's important, though, that I was trying to get the story at that point when that they had given up on their sort of human team. They used to have a roving human team who used to go out and say, someone's going to cause problems at some point, or this one is, then, you know, call it in. But they got rid of that team about 2015, 2016, something like that. So there's a problem there.
It seems like there's something about our need to see. I think we're uncomfortable with things that are vague or not tangible, aren't they? So we try and make everything tangible or concrete, and so that we can kind of try and grab hold of it. So in the end, you end up spending masses of amount of time collecting data that you can count, rather than being assured that there's a quality to the service. I was just thinking, David Jones, about your involvement in the enabling environment. Because obviously there are tick boxes that of standards that are to be met, and I wonder if that runs the risk of turning into a tick box culture, rather than, obviously, the original intention is to drive up standards of quality in services.
Well, that's a very good question. I'm sure there is that risk there, and I think for people who are at the other end, that is those who are in the so-called enabling environments, the temptation is to find lots of material to fit those particular boxes. And in fact, you can often go into establishments and you'll see on the wall they've got a kind of sheet with envelopes hanging from them, and they'll have 10, because there are 10 standards, and people come and put bits of paper, you know, into those, which is supposed to be evidence which backs up how they meet the standards. So that in that way it does directly affect the behaviour of those staff.
We really need to talk about Goodhart's law.
Yeah.
Goodhart's law, which is the sort of, it's an economics law about monetary discipline, but it applies to everything. Increasingly really applies to any sort of standards of that sort.
Is tick box more popular in some cultures than others, David? You know, it seems like it's very pervasive in Britain, and, you know, are we more prone to tick box culture than some other societies?
Definitely, I think so. I think we've just borrowed some of the American culture whole. Somehow we bulldozed that as well. So I think that the Blair government was very, this is where most of this comes from, I think, originally. Very nervous at 2003, after the Iraq War, they really need to make an effect on something, and this came along, and that was why they spent all that money on the NHS computer system at that stage, 2003, 2004. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. It'd be, you know, interesting to see whether the quality of service does end up better where there are these tick boxes as opposed to societies where they're less dependent on it. But it's clear there's an emotional cost to tick box culture in terms of, you know, we talked about people disconnecting from themselves or real people's lives being affected in quite devastating ways. Is there a financial cost to tick box?
Well, I think there is if you count all the mistakes that they may cause. I suppose definitely. And there's also financial cost because I think it never quite hits the nail on the head, does it? So I think if you need to really be effective as a public servant, you need to hit the nail on the head, exactly, precisely. Then you only have to do the job once. If you don't do that, you have to do the job over and over again. Whether you can do that without the help of ordinary people, I'm not sure. Part of the problem with tick boxes is that these things can be professionalised. And it can't be. You need to have other people supporting you. Certainly in your job, I'm sure that, you know, if somebody's got a supportive family outside prison, supportive community, they're much more likely not to go back there. I don't know about these things really, but...
Also, I guess you need a kind of like infrastructure in place to collect data for tick box, don't you? So that might involve people that are monitoring tick box, KPIs, I guess. So the people that are monitoring those things, the people that set them in place, the amount of time that people spend going to meetings to prove that they're meeting those KPIs, it just seems like there's lots of costs. And I wonder, you know, how much evidence there is of people making up figures, just, you know, it's that stuff about massaging the data, isn't it? And people using stats to be able to make whatever point they wish to make, rather than...
Well, that's the problem with Goodhart's Law, it happens the whole time.
Okay.
And that's where Goodhart's Law comes in, I think, that as soon as something becomes identified as a standard to be met, people start gaming it and it becomes ineffective.
Even without meaning to, I think they do, because, you know, I think it sort of becomes a sort of social way in which you do things at that point. But I remember the way in which as journalists we used to in the old days be expected to fiddle our own expenses, we're paying ourselves. I'm not saying I did it or anything, but, you know, I had expense all flung back at me by my editor saying, no, add this and that and that. That's the way in which one does these things. And your bosses will want you to do that because it makes them look better.
Well, that's an interesting point, David, because we had a massive parliamentary scandal around just that issue when Thatcher decided that it was better for MPs to claim expenses than have a pay rise. And then 20 years later, of course, the Telegraph caused a collapse in confidence in our political system.
It's the Duck Islands and all that.
Yes.
Duck Islands.
Yeah. Exactly.
Last year, I also happened to read the Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande. At first glance, it might look as if you're both writing about something similar, but from opposing perspectives, but you actually deal with this in your book. Could you say something about this?
Well, I think I read that book too, so it was a bit of worry to start off with. I think what was happening though is that he's talking about checklists, which are different, because they're under your control as a professional. When you have a checklist, it's to help you support you yourself, doesn't report anything to anybody. Tick box is different, that's some sort of system above you which controls you and what you do. I think he recognised that Gawande as well, his latest to this stuff about doctors.
Yeah, I think that's a really good explanation of why, on the face of it, something that looks quite similar might be serving a very different purpose. And you've also founded and a director of Radix. Can you tell us something about the aims and objectives of this think tank?
Radix is it was part of my Lib Dem side of things originally. Well, the failure of the Lib Dems perhaps to think at all. So the idea was originally that we would look at how one creates an agenda for a radical centre. I'm not sure where it So I've got to broaden that now, but same time, I also spent half my life, you know, involved in Liberal Democrats, the other half for the New Economics Foundation. I've also got another think tank that's largely called New Weather.
And is that kind of, because I guess that's a form of activism, isn't it, setting up something like that to take a radical stance? And is that, has that been your way of coping with this kind of like relentless bureaucracy to try and achieve something different?
I've never really been under bureaucracy myself. It's great not to have been. You know, by the time I was in newspapers, there wasn't such a thing as bureaucracy, really. And after that, I've worked in organisations far too small. So I've never really had that problem myself. It's great.
You're very lucky.
So it seems from... Well, you did actually have a couple of years right in the centre of the establishment, in the coalition. Sorry?
I was too important, I was too independent actually to control with any sort of tick box, I'm glad to say.
Well, I was going to say that it seems to me that people might view you as a bit of a troublemaker. Have bureaucracies usually been receptive to hear your observations?
No, they never have been. I don't know why. I suppose because I'm really trying to undermine their very existence, I think. Tick box bureaucracies.
Yes.
There's no sort of middle ground, really.
Well, I recently read Adam Grant's Think Again, and he talks about disagreeable givers, which are people who offer criticism up to organisations, but it's with the intention of trying to improve what's offered, but how often the organisation might respond with a backlash because they're not willing to hear those kind of criticisms. And it seems that you would definitely fall into the camp of being a disagreeable giver, that you're offering something up to try and get a positive change to society, but actually you can, as David just said, I can imagine that would be met with quite a lot of resistance.
Yes, I mean, I think I found out, so I read The Tyranny of Numbers, much more successful in my following book, which was very positive, than a book called Authenticity, which trying to say there's this new way of looking at the world. And I was not nearly so successful, so I think that probably books which are quite iconoclastic in that way are probably more successful than ones that aren't. On the other hand, Authenticity did have a response unexpectedly from McDonald's, from people like that, who really sort of listened and put into effect to some extent. McDonald's were the last people I thought I was supposed to be helping. See why I did, perhaps, in a sense.
Where have we got to, Naomi?
I think we've finished the questions, haven't we? So I suppose the one final question that we usually ask, David, is, you know, when you're brushing up against some of the more frustrating, harsher elements of society, what are the ways that you've coped with that over the course of your career? You know, how, what's kept you feeling nourished and being able to keep positive and keep doing the work that you're doing?
How do you mean the harsh elements of society?
Well, I suppose I would see that, you know, this, you know, the stuff, the tick box stuff that you've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about, is what is, to me, appears to be one of the harsher elements of society. It, you know, with this impact on people's lives, and one could end up very frustrated and angry about the injustice of these situations. And I wonder how you've ended up kind of like not getting eaten up with anger, but managing to carry on making a positive contribution. And
I hope I have. Not sure you're right. I mean, I think that when I was writing The Human Element, for instance, I did get very cross. It took too long, really. I felt that I couldn't write the book properly. Uh-huh. It was just too cross. Just came across badly. So it was turned down twice by publishers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Drew back a bit from that and wrote in a different way. So by sort of stepping back a bit from it, I was able to be more, I think, more creative about it. It's difficult. I think that if you get too cross, it doesn't help you or your writing. It doesn't, of course, stop you getting cross, unfortunately, because I do get cross a lot. I find that I got very cross with bureaucracy of any kind. Always have been. It's a bad aspect of myself, but of writing the book has reminded me there are people behind these things too.
And are there things that help provide an antidote to that crossness, that, you know, would, if you're getting too cross, what helps you pull back and draw away from the crossness, or the thing that's making you cross?
Remembering that I'm trying to remember that I am actually being cross with the person. My children also tell me off I'm horrible people on the phone. There's no one's able to use the phone. And I'm a Parkinson's, so it makes it rather difficult to communicate anyway, being cross or not cross. All the more important things around, you know. In the end, nothing. So, I know that people who have ended up writing about very specific institutions. My friend Andrew Sims, for instance, wrote about Tesco. He wrote a very successful book called Tescopoly. And I think in the end he said that what they didn't realise is that by writing this book I'm kissing them goodbye. In a sense, after years of obsession with them, you'd be able to write the book, get rid of it like that. So, I'm quite sure. I think I'm perhaps doing the same with tick books, in a sense. I'm writing about it, getting it out there, hopefully. Other people will run with it.
I think that's quite an interesting concept, that by kind of like packaging all that up, that it is a way of saying goodbye to something that's quite frustrating or anger-provoking.
The trouble is, of course, now having set out this concept, tick box, you didn't see it everywhere.
Yes.
Not just when you're writing the book, you can't stop seeing it. So I've carried on sort of blogging about it, but what can you do? Especially, you know, when you're then at the end of the NHS yourself and you can see yourself being tick boxed endlessly. You can't actually say anything about it because you haven't got the voice anymore. It's very annoying.
Well, in some ways that's quite a good thing, isn't it? As long as everybody can see it, and not just you, me and Naomi and the others who are most affected.
That's true.
Because then it's just persecution.
Yes. As long as the doctors and nurses can see it. I think it's the ones people are dealing with who can see it, not just the people at the end of the system can see it. But often the people who can't see it are the richest, most successful people in the world. The people who can see it aren't the people who aren't the ones running the world. You've got a problem.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, isn't it, about the people at the top being the, you know, it's them that it's fueling, but actually it's having a detrimental effect on so many other people. So actually finding ways to draw the attention to the people at the top of the problem.
But in the end, you know, I think that if you can do that, then things will run better and more effectively. Effectiveness is really what they want as well as us. So in the end, it's hopeful. We need some experiments for alternatives, I think. And they're doing a bit in Holland, but not really here so much. When I wrote about I said to Lord Faulkner one day, when he was the cabinet minister in charge of the cabinet office, I was writing about numbers and he said targets, and he said, what else can we do? I said, I don't think we've really got any alternatives yet. Tick box. Some sort of tick box.
So what's happening in Holland?
Well, there's an interesting thing there where they all get together. They all get together, and in their health service, and they say, "Well, what bureaucratic regulations can we get rid of? Let's get rid of those." So, in a sense, the great experiment was done during the lockdown, when they simply stripped the place of any sort of regulations that got in the way. Because they said to them, I remember, in the Northwest, anyway, because you're adults. We're all adults here, we can deal with these things. So they were adults before, of course. Suddenly adults in lockdown. Always adults.
Yeah, it sounds quite appealing. Let's have a meeting to see what bureaucracy we can get rid of without having to have a pandemic.
Well, except that the other side of that is, to some extent, what Trump did during his 4 years to abolish as many regulations as possible, and all of a sudden you've got a pipeline built across, you know, a pristine wasteland in northern Alaska.
Well, that's the danger, yes, exactly. Because if you get rid of all the, and you've got to get rid of your consciences as well, haven't you?
Quite.
To make that happen. But I think, you know, if you've get rid of, you first of all, tick box gets rid of all our consciousness, we can't see anything clearly. You get rid of tick box, then you've got nothing at all. Have you? It's difficulty.
Well, I think the introduction of the conscience into the equation is essential, isn't it?
Yeah. Not just consciousness, being able to see clearly, I think. I don't think people can really in the moment. The stick box gets in the way. So when Michael Gove attacks experts, I think that's what he's attacking really. It's the ways in which, I think I've never spoken to him, I've never met him actually. But I think that that's what he's talking about. So all expertise has been sort of shoved into these sort of tram lines. And think outside them. Think outside the box, they say.
Okay. That's been really interesting, David.